Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, and thanks for joining us today. We are with Andrea Jennings with RE/MAX All-Stars in Riverside. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
You bet. Let's go back. When did you first get your license?
Well, I first started when I was 18. My father was a commercial broker, and I got my license only for the reason of having to work for him.
Okay. And what year was that about?
Oh, now you're going to make me tell my age.
Sorry.
That would be in the late 80s.
Okay. And how soon after that did we meet? Do you remember?
I met you in, I believe, the end of 1993.
93. Up until then, what was your, when you were in residential real estate, what was your typical transaction or client before we met?
Well, before I met you, I was a relatively new agent, and I worked strictly with buyers.
Okay. And in that market, was that, that kind of had changed to where the market wasn't going up anymore. So what was the, I guess, what was the type of buyer? Were they typically first-time buyers, and did they have much money down? What was the market like?
Back then, when we first started working together, FHA was a very popular loan program.
Okay.
We didn't have the zero-down products that we currently have.
Okay.
And the minimum then was a 3% down loan FHA product, and the people that we were working with were definitely first-time buyers and wonderful people to work with, excited about buying a home, but very time-intensive. Definitely a lot of hand-holding back then and speaking to them.
Kind of nervous about closing their first transaction.
Absolutely. They had no idea even how the transaction was going to progress and really relied on me a lot to help them through every process.
Okay. Now, after you and I met, we started doing transactions, and we probably did many dozen over the probably the next 5 or 6 years. Most realtors don't like to work with investors. Why do they? Why have they concluded that, and why did you find the experience different?
There was two reasons for me. One, because I was a relatively new agent. I think I was very open to your ideas when you came in and spoke to me and told me what you did and how you did it.
Mm-hmm.
I found it to be exciting, and I wanted to learn. I think, secondly, the difference between working with an investor and working with a first-time buyer was, as you as an investor were very focused in what you were looking for, you were very focused in how much you were going to pay for the property and how you were going to negotiate it, where a first-time buyer really didn't have that kind of guidance, weren't really sure what they were doing as far as what they wanted to pay for a property, offer on a property, and how the process worked. When I first started, though, and told people I was working with an investor, yes, there was a very negative connotation to that word. It was, and I know you've heard all of them, buyer, you know, it was your flaky, investors are flaky. They'll type a property and then not close. They won't have the money. And those were things that I never experienced working with you.
Okay. During that stretch that you were an agent, let's say between 90 and 96, did you own a home? And if you did, when did you buy it?
I didn't start working until residential real estate until 93.
Okay.
And that's when I also bought my first home.
Okay.
So I came into the marketplace at the tail end of what had been a very hot market, the late 80s,
mm-hmm.
that had started flattening out. And then after I bought my house, started declining.
Okay. So you found yourself upside down where you owed more than the property was worth?
Yes, I did. And it wasn't a great feeling. But I think because of our relationship and being able to buy some investment properties, I made the decision to stay in that property and to wait the market out and buy investment properties during that cycle.
Okay. There's going to be a lot of people perhaps in that situation now where the next few years they'll find themselves owing more than the property is worth. What would be your advice to them? Because there'll be choices to walk away, stick it out. So what would you advise them?
My advice is going to be based on their job situation, and I think, first of all, if they're in a job situation that is allowing them to stay in the property, that I would stay in the property and do what I did, which was work, keep that particular property, and look for investments in order to buy other property in a declining market.
Okay.
I would never make my first choice personally to walk away from a home if I was able to afford the home.
Okay.
Obviously, we have people that have job loss, divorce, illness that are not. And then they're going to be looking for different solutions to that problem.
When you were first in the business, do you recall what the prevailing interest rate was?
Well, when I bought my house, VA had just come out with an adjustable rate mortgage, and I remember buying my house at 5.5, and during the years I had it, it went up to 8.5 prior to refinancing it. But during that time, we were really staying anywhere from about 7.5 to about 9.
Okay. So obviously now, if somebody has financing on the property, it's probably very favorable financing. So if they decided to walk away from it, it may be, if they hurt their credit, they may not be qualifying for a while. And when they do get a chance to qualify, the interest rate could be considerably different.
I definitely, that's correct. We have phenomenal financing right now, financing that we haven't seen, and you would have the exact quote, 30 some years,
yeah.
So I think we do have people that have favorable financing, and again, if it's a payment that they can afford, they're not going to be getting financing like that again, I think, for some time to come.
After 1998, the real estate market started to go up, and then it really started taking off all the way through 2005. How did that change the job of a realtor?
Well, of course, it made our job easier.
That's probably true in one way. I would say, let me just ask a couple questions. Usually when that happens, more and more people decide that that's their chosen career. So has that happened?
Absolutely. I've never seen as many realtors in the marketplace as there is now. And that has made our job harder, because when you have as many realtors as we have now competing to work in our marketplace, it is very difficult because people have a lot of choices, and just about every person they know is a realtor.
Right. So it's almost, if I don't list it with Aunt Betty, then I'm going to be in big trouble.
Or my brother. Yes.
Yeah, or your brother. How does that work out typically? I'm just curious if they almost feel obligated to list it with somebody because of a friendship or relationship. Is that fraught with some issues that they may not have expected?
I have gotten several calls over the past years with people that have listed with brand new agents that have usually been some kind of a relationship to them, and it hasn't always been a positive experience for them, and they have many times wished that they had listed with us, and especially in the particular area we work. We've worked there 12 years, and I would say know a great deal about our marketplace, our inventory, and what prices are doing there.
In the beginning, you worked with pretty much buyers, first-time buyers, and did that transition to where you were really going after listings and farming?
Absolutely. I feel very fortunate that in the beginning I worked with buyers and also worked with you, because it built the platform for my business that, so when we transitioned into this very hot market that we have been in, most of my past clients were calling me to sell their houses and move up into a bigger house, and that definitely set the stage for me to have a lot of repeat business.
Okay. Let's talk about the typical buyer that's purchased, say, in 2003 to 2005. Were they cautious about taking on debt?
Absolutely not. Those buyers, and I love Bruce's term, euphoria. That was the euphoria time period, and were scared, actually, that they weren't going to be able to buy a house, and were doing just about everything they could to get into the housing market.
Were the buyers typically first-time buyers or move-up buyers, would you say?
We had both, but our first-time buyers definitely have declined considerably, and most of the buyers that we have had in the past, really 2 years, have all been move-up buyers.
What is the price range that you're typically dealing with in the farm that you work?
Well, it's changed. If you're asking in, you know, the last year, there really is hardly anything in our farm under $400,000, but only recently have they built high-end houses, so our typical price range goes from about $400,000 to $600,000.
Have you noticed any change in price that people are selling at in the last 6 months? Has there been a change in that?
Absolutely. What we've really seen, and I will put this back on the realtors who are not doing their job properly, is they've been telling sellers what they want to hear.
Correct.
Which isn't the reality.
Right.
And then we have seen a huge amount of price reductions on the multiple listing system, simply to be able to correct the house in order to get it sold.
Correct. So our listings have expanded a great deal. The competition to sell when you're selling, there's just a lot more inventory to sell against. Is that accurate?
Yes. I mean, 3 years ago, you could not put a sign in a lawn without having, within 2 days, multiple offers. That is definitely not what we're seeing now, and houses will not sell if they're not priced correctly now.
Going back to that stretch of years where everything boomed, what was the typical financing that people were getting?
I was a listing agent then, and I would say 80% of the people were buying on a zero down adjustable rate mortgage. most of them adjusting in a what we called a 2.28 loan, which was 2 years, some of them 3 years. Most of them were all thinking because the market was going up, they would be able to refinance and get out of these loans within the next 2 years.
The payment that, was it subprime mortgages? Is that the kind that's 2.28? Is that the typical?
There was a lot of people at that time that had a, what we call a low FICO score.
Okay.
That were buying zero down. They were also doing stated income loans. All of that's going to be changing now.
That's correct. Typically, stated income, is that number come from imagination sometimes just because that's the number they need to qualify?
We have to be careful there.
Yeah, we do.
The number, you know, that we were told was the stated income, yes, for them to be able to purchase our particular listing. It was their lender's job to make sure that they were being qualified and being able to afford the house that they were buying.
Yeah. A recent study from a little sampling from the IRS showed that 90% of those stated income loans exaggerated their income, but 60% of them exaggerated it by 50%, which kind of brings up the next point. That cycle of coming due with that payment that's now going to change, starting to happen in 2006, 7, and 8, and when the market's flat, I think that's why you're seeing some pretty anxious sellers because they are not really able to afford the payment as it adjusts.
We're seeing a completely different seller right now. 2 years ago, we were seeing a seller who said, I'm cashing out and I'm moving out of state and I'm going to put a large down or pay cash somewhere else. And the majority of our clients were all moving out of state. The calls we're getting now are from people mostly in newer homes. That did buy these huge houses with large payments who did not put in any padding. We call it an escrow or impound account for their taxes and homeowners insurance, mm-hmm. and didn't comprehend that the payment the lender was giving them did not include their property tax.
It may not even have included not only no principal reduction, but maybe not even the full interest.
We've seen those too, and we've gotten a lot of calls in the last, and it's really been the last few months of people asking us to come and say, you know, what can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And when we tell them what their house is worth, they're realizing, oh, I have a first, I have a second, and now I owe $7,000, $10,000 in back property tax. And they don't have a lot of options available to them.
During that stretch of 2003 to 2005 where the market was just exploding and it seemed very easy to be a realtor, how often did you find yourself in an escrow where the other agent was very inexperienced? And if you found that, what problems arise from that?
We found it constantly. In the 90s, even though we were in a recessionary market, we didn't have the amount of realtors that we currently have now. Mm-hmm. And we worked a lot with the same realtors over and over again. And I liked the relationships that we had with them. In this cycle, especially being a listing agent, very rarely did I know the other agent writing an offer and generating it on our listing. And that was a very time-consuming process for us because we didn't have the basis of the relationship. So we constantly had to go through cleaning up their offers, tracking down their lenders, and finding out really if they were qualified.
So you end up kind of doing both sides of the transaction because it simply wouldn't close if you didn't?
Absolutely. You do a lot more work with new agents. And new agents have a lot of enthusiasm, and I applaud them for that, but they also don't take a lot of time to educate themselves.
The sellers, are they willing to be realistic and hear the numbers that are real, or they still want a number that probably they're hoping for rather than what's real?
If you're asking the question now, I would say that sellers are becoming more realistic in the marketplace simply because the amount of inventory that they are seeing just driving around their own neighborhoods. 6 months ago, we still had sellers that absolutely were not realistic and would not discount the price or look at what was going on in their neighborhood.
Okay. When someone finds themselves close to that break-even point where they don't have a whole lot of equity, but maybe they have enough to think they can sell the home themselves, what do you think of someone taking that on in this market? What are some of the problems that they might encounter that they're not anticipating?
I think the primary one is people don't understand all the disclosures and the laws involved in selling their own home.
Most agents probably fit that category because they change so quickly.
They do change. And I think that's why it's very important to continue to educate yourself and to keep very updated on what's going on. So I would say that's the primary thing is that they don't really understand the whole process that happens. And many times I have what we call for sale by owners call me and say, you know, I had a buyer, they're kind of interested. what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have to tell them, you know, this is my job. That's why we list your property, and that's why we're here to walk you through the entire process.
It must be very difficult, because I don't sell my own properties because I just don't have the time to deal with the looky-loos or the sellers. I mean, really, one of the biggest problems is how do you show the property efficiently and enough times for it to be sold. So I would imagine the MLS is a great tool for all of the people that look at that are other agents. And typically, is that true? Is that listings are sold by other agents as opposed to yourself?
Prior to the explosion of the internet, absolutely, the MLS was a primary place for us to sell our houses. We also, back then, though, also had so many people that would drive around our neighborhoods, pull our flyers, call us on our signs. We hardly see that anymore at all. What we see is most of the buyers, and the latest statistic, and I don't know if this is correct, says 75% will get on the internet first, surf the internet, find the properties they're interested in, and then most likely contact the listing agent.
Okay.
So we don't see a lot of that we used to, where buyers will call us on our signs or our flyers or our ads even.
You have a farm. It's about 2,000 people that you've regularly mailed to. And you've told me that you've noticed some changes in responses. Can you share that with us?
Absolutely. What I've seen in the last 4 months is a lot of my mailers are coming back with the properties being vacant. So we're seeing a large amount of properties in this farm that we work with, the properties being vacant. And we just had a conversation yesterday. I'm trying to figure out now, where are these people going and why are they walking away from their houses?
And very much likely they probably will be a high percentage of lender-owned property someday, because if they've given up, that could be an indication that there's nothing left but the lender to take back.
And I think that sellers need to take some responsibility for that. The last several years, I'm going to steal Bruce's term, they've used their houses as ATM cash machines, and they've just absolutely tapped out their equity in their homes.
Is the market that we're finding ourselves starting into remind you of one that you've seen before?
Absolutely, and I feel very fortunate that I worked with you in the early 90s, because at the time, I hadn't seen this market. I didn't know what to expect. I wasn't an agent in the late 80s, so I didn't see that boom. I only got to see the down part of it, the downturn. So absolutely, this mimics a lot of what we saw in the 90s.
In a challenging market, what can a seller do to assist you in doing a good job for them?
Two things are going to be important in this marketplace. One of them is your house is going to have to be the best. It's going to have to be the sharpest, the cleanest, the nicest, because you're going to have a lot of competition. Or it's going to have to be the cheapest.
Okay. So it has to present the best value.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any purpose in giving it a shot, listing it at a higher number just to see what happens?
No, I disagree with that. I've always disagreed with that theory. And we've had a lot of sellers that have always said that to us. Well, just put it in the MLS and see if anything happens. All you are is going to be a sign that people just constantly drive by saying, gosh, they haven't sold that house yet. And I don't agree with that at all. I think if you're realistic in selling your house, then you need to be realistic in looking at what's going on in the marketplace. And that's not just your comparable solds. It's also what your current actives and what is for sale around you.
Absolutely. Do you find that a lot of very honest agents lose listings to other agents that are just willing to go for the higher number?
Absolutely. That's happened to me several times over the past years. I've told people what their house is worth, and they haven't agreed with that, and I respect it, and I haven't taken the listing. I purposely have not taken the listing,
mm-hmm.
and I track them, and what I find is they've become price reductions, and I've also find that they're very frustrated, and the second realtor they're calling is getting that. They're, you know, gosh, I was on the market for 4 months. I never got my house shown, never sold it, and, you know, now I'm tired of being on the market.
What makes another agent a pleasure to deal with? Because you've dealt with repetitive people. And so what is the difference between having that experience?
I think what I really enjoy working with in an agent is that we have an understanding that we have a common goal. My job, if I'm representing the seller, is to sell the house and to close escrow so my clients can go on to where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
And their job representing the buyer is, you know, to purchase this house. The buyer is obviously interested in and wants to purchase, and that all the parties communicate and work together, because we all have a common goal. We're not combative with one another, and that's what I found a lot with these new agents is they're extremely combative, and don't want to say, here's what our problem is, now can we work together and let's solve it.
You know, what's interesting about that, as a real estate investor, I always thought that that was one of the things that I kind of brought to the party, was experience, that I've been involved in a lot of transactions, and there's always that day that it could fall out, it seems.
Yes, sir.
And it's at that day that you need somebody on the other side to go, well, why don't we do this, or why don't we make this concession, and for that to make the transaction work, because you really don't gain much by starting over again. That was... We just were in a transaction like that where silly delays for a week. And from a seller's side, there's no point in being impatient. That's just real estate. But when you have two agents, that can change because that agent may not have control of their client. And it could be, you can end up with a lot of canceled transactions for very silly reasons.
And I think the important thing for an agent is to remember is you need to step back and remember that you are representing somebody. You're not a party to that transaction, and, mm-hmm. and I think it's important for agents to remember that and say, okay, what can I do that's in the best interest of my client?
Okay. Kind of in that vein, you've seen me buy a lot of properties, all of which I've bought below market. If you had a seller that were that was motivated and in kind of one of those situations, when do you feel it would be appropriate for an investor to make an offer and actually purchase somebody else's property?
Again, I think it goes back to what is happening in the seller's life because, as you know, when you're not an investor, a home is a very emotional purchase. So if a seller is in a difficult situation, I think what's best for them is to sit down and say, okay, I've lost my job. I'm, you know, 2 months behind, and I've got an investor who's willing to help me in this situation. I think this is my best course because now I'm in a declining market. My house price is not going up, and I've only got, what, a month left, 2 months left to solve the situation.
Okay. The number of agents have probably never been higher. You got a lot of agents that have never seen this cycle that we're starting to go through that will probably get increasingly numbers of foreclosures and lender properties to deal with. What advice from your past experience would you give these new agents to say, okay, if you want to continue making a living in the next 3 or 4 years, how will they have to change what they do?
Again, I can't stress this enough. You need to look at the whole picture of what's going on with your client. Why are they selling? What is their motivation behind it? And where are they going? And if they're in a financial situation that is difficult for them, you have to step back when you go onto that listing appointment and say, let's talk about what's the best situation for you. Because
mm-hmm.
I'm not here to list your house.
That's,
I'm here.
What an interesting concept.
And that is. I'm here to help you.
Mm-hmm.
And we have different avenues. You know, we can talk about, hey, you have maybe enough equity to sell it to an investor that would be attracted to them, or you don't, and maybe we need to discuss a short sale, and here's the ramifications of that. And really find out why they're selling their house and how you can help them prior to you ever taking that listing.
Why would somebody consider buying a property now if prices are likely to gradually go down, let's say, for the next 3 or 4 years?
That's a great question, and I thought a lot about that. I love being a homeowner. So I think that a lot of people like to know that they can go out and plant flowers in their yard or paint that burgundy color that nobody else would have in their dining room,
mm-hmm.
That you can have a dog and let him come inside when it's raining. Because as a renter, you don't have those choices.
Mm-hmm.
You've signed a contract that says, oh, I don't have a dog. I'm not going to paint this wall. And you're certainly not going to go plant flowers and put it in someone else's yard. I think that's one reason. I think secondly, too, is that the conception of homeownership the last couple of years, I don't necessarily agree with. It's all been about how much can I make off of this house?
Absolutely.
Where I think that we need to get back to this is our home. This is where we want to live. This is where we want to come home to after a hard day at work. And we enjoy being in the space, and that's why we're buying it.
Right. You've joined me today because you are the best agent that I've ever dealt with and the most honest. And I want you to have a chance to share your phone number with people so they can get in touch with you.
Well, I appreciate that compliment, and thank you so much.
You bet.
I work again for RE/MAX All-Stars in Riverside. Our direct number is 951, area code 780-9988. Again, that's 780-9988.
Thank you so much for joining. It's been a lot of fun. Next week, Craig Hill with the Norris Group and how to get access to a lot of money if you're an investor.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.